Hello and welcome to the SEAI's 180 Degrees podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan, and over the course of the next 12 episodes, I'll be joined by special guests to talk about the state of play of Ireland's energy revolution, how we can be smarter energy users, what renewable technologies are coming into our homes and communities, and how small businesses can benefit from decarbonising now. Today, we are going to kick off the season with some smart ways to reduce your energy use at home, saving you money and carbon emissions. I'm delighted to be joined by the SEAI's Brian McIntyre, who has been working in the energy sector for a very long time, and architect Andre Negri, owner and director at Studio Negri, which transforms houses into A-rated luxury homes. Now, we're going to discuss everything from keeping your own energy bills down, and that's very important at the moment, and some low and no cost solutions to helping you make your home better and warmer. We'll also discuss the bigger investment options that are available and, of course, all the grants that the SEAI provides towards retrofitting your homes. You're very welcome, Brian and Andre.
Thank you very much, Sinead.
Now, let's start with a question that'll be, I think, probably relevant to everybody listening, but one which still confuses me the most. What are the hungriest energy users in the home?
Well, the main one is your heating, your space heating, water heating. That typically looks about 80% of your energy use in the home. Then you have things like the cooker, washing machine, tumble dryer, especially this time of year for a lot of people, and electric showers would be a big one as well.
Now, they all sound to me like completely necessary appliances.
Absolutely.
So if that's the case, and we have all these things here, it's difficult for homes and homeowners to kind of reduce their energy consumption on those big items. I mean, things like the tumble dryer and the immersion, we're in Ireland, we all know what that's like to keep on. So is this about just using it sporadically or less often or for shorter periods? What's the best way to deal with that?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. Like, obviously, we talk about things like reducing the temperature in the house, but we don't want people to be cold in their home. So it's about making people more aware of the temperature it's at, and could you be as comfortable or still comfortable in your home at the lower temperature? So, like, we talk about 20 degrees or 19 degrees in your house. A lot of people actually don't know what temperature their house is at, and the thermostat could be bumped up to 24 or 25. And it's just about, you could test it out, say, turn it back to 23. Is it comfortable to turn it back to 22 and bring it down and see, is there a point at where you're still comfortable but the temperature is lower? And that could, like, 1 degree could make a difference about 10% in your energy bill. Things like, anyone has a boiler, a new boiler from the last 10 or 15 years, it's set at a high temperature. So the water flowing out of it is probably too high. So it actually affects the efficiency of the heating system. So they're supposed to be high efficiency boilers, but they're not actually getting into efficient mode. So even just the panel at the front has a dial that you can just turn back from 70 or 80 to 60. And that makes it operate much more efficiently. It's about 10% difference in efficiency of that. Mm-hmm. And
right.
It's a simple change to make.
I'll be honest now, I've never actually looked at my boiler. I get a chap in every year to service
exactly.
it and send him on his way. But actually, you know, I'm terrified of knobs and switches and anything in case the whole thing blows up. So you're saying get friendly with your appliances and understand how they work.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they'll all have manual. Everyone looks online for these things anyway rather than keeping manuals and just to see where the temperature is at. And typically the dial goes from 30 to 80. So if you just, it'll often be set up to the top end of the max and just turn it back a little bit to about around 60. So it'll enter into an efficient operation.
Okay.
So you don't really affect the temperature in the house or the comfort. It's still knocking out the water at 60 degrees to heat your radiators.
Yeah.
But it makes it operate that much more efficiently.
And there's always a YouTube video to look at, isn't
exactly.
there, to get you there?
Exactly.
All right. And in terms of the radiators then, so talk to me a little bit about that, because sometimes they make it they make a gurgling sound, or, you know, when some of them don't come on as efficiently as others. Is there an argument for, you know, bleeding them or how often now?
Yeah, you should probably try and do them at least once a year. The same as you'd service them. And I just bought keys to do it myself because I'd lost the keys when we moved. So just like there's a key at the back of it or at the side of it.
Okay.
And just turn it anti-clockwise till you start hearing a hissing sound. obviously yeah,
have a bucket ready.
Exactly, and a towel and something to catch the water if anything sprays out.
Right.
But that just means that it allows the water to fill up the radiator and you get the heat, so it heats up quicker or gets to the temperature. So you're not left in a room that's not getting to the temperature you want, where you start bumping up the heating then to try and get the warm.
So that's a good thing to do this time of year, because we're going to have the heating on a little bit more and you get to kind of your house winter ready, as it were.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the other appliances you mentioned there, the cooker and the washing machine and the tumble dryer, of course, we know is a killer. Do you advocate then, Brian, washing things at a lower... is it the heating of the water that causes the problem in terms of the cost?
Yeah, about 90% of the energy used by washing machine is to heat the water. So it's, so it's one of those things, like, it always seems counterintuitive when you just put on the eco mode and it says it's going to run for 2.5 hours. You think, well, that's way too long. I normally run for 50 minutes, but it's actually running at a lower temperature. So a lot of the clothes you'd wear don't get dirty, such like sports gear or whatever might get dirty, might need a 30 or 40 degrees.
There's no need for the boil wash these days, just so good detergent.
Yeah, 20, 25, 30 degrees, it'll wash it perfectly adequately, and that just saves a lot of energy in what you use.
Okay, good to know. And Andre, let me bring you in here, because you're visiting people's homes all the time and you're looking at ways to do things smarter. Do you find that a lot of those problems are eliminated now, certainly when it comes to heating, in the newer kind of new build A-rated homes, or the ones that are retrofitted to A or B?
Yes, definitely. Once a house has been retrofitted to an A-rated standard, well, then usually you have a heat pump that's looking after the heating of the house. And I find that a heat pump is best left alone, and its first job is to heat the water. So it's contrary to having a gas boiler where you should only heat the water when necessary. But with a heat pump, it's heated at a low temperature, using less energy, so it's always warm, and the house is always at a constant temperature. And that's what makes people feel comfortable. They can walk around with just a t-shirt on and you're comfortable. And it's not power hungry, it's not expensive to keep it at that temperature.
So is it going to be a generational thing? I mean, you know, in the next 30 years or 50 years, that practically all the homes that are being built now are built to this high standard. So we don't need to worry about any of this stuff. Or is it the case that we constantly need to be on top of our own personal energy consumption?
Well, we need to stay on top of it, because all new homes have to be a minimum of an A2. And in order to avail of the grants, you have to retrofit your house to a minimum of a B2. And our job is to retrofit as many homes as possible to get them up to that level. But also, once you're there, just following on from what Brian was saying, you know, when you're using your washing machine and your dishwasher, you should try and have them on nitrate electricity, which is half the price as normal day rate electricity. And just try and minimize your usage as well. Like, it's just something simple like an oven uses double the amount of electricity as an air fryer. Air fryer is much smaller, it's much more efficient, and most of the time you can cook most of your meals with an air fryer. Now, not your Christmas dinner.
We're getting into controversial territory here now, I must say. I'm not sure about that. Maybe the chips. I know there are advocates of the old air fryer who say their lives have been transformed. I must say, only my chips have been transformed with mine. But you make a really good point there. And actually, when we're talking about the wider appliances then, Brian, this is where the smart meter rollout actually helps, because there's 1.2 million homes out there now who've been fitted with a smart meter. I'm delighted to say I'm one of them. Not sure I fully understand what it's all about, but what I am getting are emails now telling me what I'm using where. And do you think that information is helpful then to homeowners?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, people don't understand what they're using, when they're using it, and how they're using it. So any bit of information that gives people an understanding of what they're using, when they're using it.
And it can kind of nudge behaviour, maybe,
exactly,
in the way that we want. I know on mine, I was stunned to find out that my biggest usage, because it breaks it down in a little graphic for me, was the vampire use. Brian, tell me what vampire use is.
There's a lot of that's just been with machines or equipment left on overnight on standby. It just typically drains. You're even if it's switched off, like, it's still using energy. So it's a lot of, like, the energy being used that people aren't aware of.
Just leaving the telly plugged in and
the
laptop.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, it's a behavioural thing. Again, like, these are small things you can make a difference with, but every little bit counts. Like any way you can reduce your bills by just plugging things out at night. I mean, it's just we're not leave it in because of convenience, but it's not that difficult to plug something out and plug it back in the next day. So it's all those little things that we can do, just behavioural things that don't cost us anything. Like, for example, we always talk about this one thing about boiling kettles and don't fill the kettle too much. Getting electric showers are a big user of electricity. So if you spend an extra 5 minutes in the shower when it's an electric shower, you're finished and it's just kind of a comfort thing. You're just going to stand here for a few minutes. That's about 20 minutes of a kettle boiling. So just kind of give you an idea of the difference.
I'll tell you what's an expensive energy user, a teenager. And if you have a house full of them under the shower, Brian, does the SEAI offer any solutions of knocking off the shower and getting them out of it?
I did see a monitor before you could plug onto the shower hose and had a polar bear standing on a piece of ice. And the longer the shower was running for, the ice melted underneath. So it's kind of a very visual thing.
Love it. I'd love a switch that turns it freezing cold and they jump out in fright. Anyway.
Well, I would say that what makes a lot of homeowners more aware of the electricity usage they're using is placing solar panels on the roof, and you're given an app. And I found that people are very aware of what they're using because the app is telling you in real time how much electricity you're generating, how much you're using, and especially if you have a battery or not. Because, you know, if you don't have a battery, you use it or lose it. So people try and use as much energy as they can during the day while they're generating electricity. Whereas if you have a battery, it's okay to just store that energy in the battery, and then you can use it again at the night rate. So it has really made people more aware of what they're using. And like for myself, we use Electric Island, and I went over all our bills for the last 6 months to find out, well, how many kilowatts are we using every day? How much do we use at daytime? How much do we use at nighttime? And then try and analyze how you can improve that.
So it's no different in one way to the kind of the EV, the electric vehicle, where you have that. You want to induce a little bit of range anxiety, you know, that you're running it down. And actually, in a future podcast, we are going to be discussing both solar panels and indeed EV cars. So we'll get a little bit more insight into that. Brian, every time my bill drops through the door or into my inbox, as it is now, I still remain confused by some of the terminology in it. And there's lots of acronyms and lots. We're all trying to get the bill down and we're looking at the bottom line. But there are bits in it that I think lots of people don't understand. So give us an idea of things like the PSO, the public service obligation, the carbon levies. You know, these are fixed charges, are they?
Yeah, essentially they're fixed charges that go on to the top. The standing charges that are there from the supplier might be different. And that's one thing I found when I've been switching suppliers, that while you might think of a lower rate for your electricity use, if you look at it across the year, the standing charges might be the thing that makes the difference between two companies. So one might have a lower rate, but the standing charges are higher. Generally, the PSO levies and those kind of fixed charges would be mostly static, but the standing charges can be different for different suppliers.
Okay, so we can't do anything about those, but we can check the standing charges with different suppliers
exactly.
And as you say, different rates across the usage. Okay, now one of the important things we should know, I suppose, for our home is our BER. Andre, what is it and how can we find out?
Well, your BER is your building energy rating, and it advises on how much energy you're using, and typically a BER report tells you what type of windows you have, what type of energy usage you have, how much insulation you have, and then you get anything from A to a G, G being the worst. And most of our jobs is to take buildings that with the lowest energy usage energy rating and bring them up to an A rating. And that's why most customers want an extension in the back, and we try and encourage them not to have an extension and rather try and put all the energy into upgrading your house so that your house can perform at its peak, rather than putting the bulk of your money into the extension and then letting the rest of the house suffer.
Now, I know that you must get your BER rating when you're selling your home, because you can't advertise it without it. But can you kind of get it anyway? How would you go about that? Do you need an engineer into the house? What does it cost?
It's easy enough to get. Now, typically, if you're going to do a retrofit, then you need to have more than just a BER, that you need to get an advisory report, and that becomes more expensive because you have to be able to advise that you can get a B2 in order to get your grants for an energy upgrade. But in order to get a normal BER report, it's anything from 200 to 400 euro.
Okay.
And you just get your report and it tells you all the main items, like I mentioned earlier.
So that's helpful because it just inform you
very
just
helpful.
In terms of curiosity, but also that you kind of have a handle on how good or bad. Now, people will feel cold or feel warm, but this gives you a number that matches up with that, and you can decide then what you want to do about it and how you want to improve it.
Exactly. It tells you where your weak points are, really, and those are the ones that you need to try and upgrade. So your windows, what type of windows do you have? Do you single, double or triple glazing? How are they performing? You know, what type of insulation do you have? Where can you improve the house? Your insulation, what is your boiler like? So I always advise clients, look, you've either got oil or gas or electricity. And I try and encourage them to go for a heat pump. But if they don't have the budget for that, well, then the best next thing to do is to increase your boiler to have the most energy efficient boiler as possible, whether it's gas or oil. And then at least you're future-proofing it for another 10 years and there's not too much of an expense on something like that. So the BER tells you where all the weak points are in the dwelling, and then that's a good point to start and say, well, these are what I want to improve over time.
Yeah, it's a bit like embarking on a diet, isn't it? You can't start until you know what weight you are right now. It's the hard bit, you know, and then you can make decisions about it. So, Brian, it's not just houses that come with the BER rating. Modern appliances come with them as well, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Is it the same rating system?
It's quite similar. It's not exactly the same, but it's A&G, and there's different standards for different appliances.
So if you're shopping, say, for a new washing machine, what should you look out for?
Well, the better the rating, the less energy consumed. So A rating ideally, but even within certain appliances, it's down to, they may not necessarily, the ones in the market may not be, there may not be A-rated ones available, as I found out recently. So it's just to look for the best rating.
The higher, the better.
Exactly.
Okay, so the A-plus and go down from there.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when it comes to some of the retrofitting ideas that Andre was talking about there, once you have your BER rating and you realise, let's say, I have a D2, so you don't have the money to do everything you would like to do. You don't have the cash to kind of get started on a full retrofit. But there are things you can start with to try and creep that BER rating up. What would those be? Where would you start? Is it insulation, things like the attic?
The attic would be the best one. I mean, it's
you put lose your hat on. Isn't that
exactly
what they say about the house?
Exactly. Yeah. Because the heat rises and you want to keep it within the house. So about 30-35% of your heat could be lost up through the roof. And a lot of houses, I mean, people might look up the attic and say, oh, there's insulation there, but it might only be, say, 2-3 inches of insulation of, say, yellow fiberglass if the house is probably built in the 90s.
And actually, what should it be?
You'd be looking ideally at about 12 inches, 10 to 12 inches
of
that wool insulation. It depends on the material you use, but a typical house would have like wool insulation across the floor of the attic because you want to keep the heat below the ceiling where it's used. Mm. If you have a typical attic, it's not used for storing decorations and other junk that you're convinced that you'd use somewhere down the line. If you just insulate it on the rafters up on the slope of the roof, there's a lot of heat going up to heat that space in the attic that is essentially lost. So it's wasted heat that's going up if you insulate up between the rafters. So you want to keep the heat as close to the living area as possible.
Right. Now, for people listening who are looking for a weekend project, is that something you can do yourself or should you be getting somebody in for that?
Someone that would be competent could do it, but there's lots of things that to be careful of. Like, it's one of the questions we get all the time. I got a quote for insulating my attic. That's cheaper than the grant, I said. But the quote you got for insulating your attic to just insulate it is for someone to roll out another 8 inches of insulation across your attic. But if you're going to do grants, you have to make sure, it's really important to make sure you've got ventilation across your attic so you don't get the roof sweating. So you need to put ventilation around the outside. You need to insulate your pipework as well. You need to make sure that the cold water tank is insulated and then have a walkway across. So it's a different scope of work. So you just need to be careful that you're doing
a thorough job.
Yeah. It's just be mindful of making sure that you're not blocking off the ventilation. You could roll
and you
out.
Mentioned the grant there. So I know we'll get onto them in a minute now, but just if somebody just wanted to do that project and insulate their attic, is there a grant available for them to do that?
There is, because I just got one myself the other week. So yeah, you just...
Well, of course, you know you have an advantage now, Brian. You know exactly where to go and the forms to fill in. So tell the regular listeners who may not be sure.
Yeah. If you go onto the SAI website, there's a grant section at the top and you go to home grants and then there's individual energy upgrades. So it gives you a list of the different grants available there.
And does it depend then on the house type? Is that how the range works?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a lower grant, say, for apartments, then a slightly increased then for mid-terrace houses. Okay. And then again for semi-Ds and end-of-terrace, about €1,300. And then it's €1,500 for detached because it's going to cost more to do. It's based on the kind of rough approximation for the sizes of it. So okay. It's more for detached because you have a bigger roof area.
So is it fair to say then that the grant covers what? A third of the cost or half the cost?
No, last year they were increased specifically for attics and cavity walls where you'd pump the insulation to wall. And at the time when it was done, it was to try and achieve about 80% of a typical house area.
So very valuable.
Exactly, because it was just seen as if we can get people to do these very simple ones and get them, I suppose that prompts people to get more done down the line when they see the benefit of doing it.
Indeed. So something like insulating the attic, well, there you go. Like nearly the whole cost is met for you there and it's just about getting somebody in to do it. And then the other big one, of course, is the water tank. Right. Yeah. Now, I remember from my childhood, the big kind of plastic lagging jackets that went around tied off with cables. Yeah. Tell me it's improved from that.
You generally would get one that's insulated in the factory now. So it comes made with a layer of insulation that's maybe about an inch and 2 inches thick. But like a lot of people live in houses that don't have lagging jackets on them. So it's definitely worth your while spending 30 or 40 euros getting a lagging jacket.
And that means when you're heating your water and going to all that expense and effort, it stays warmer longer. Yeah. It's as simple as that. It's like the tea cozy effect.
Yeah. And even just the pipes coming off the hot water tank as well. You can get like tubes of foam in hardware shops as well. They just slide onto them to try and keep the water just insulated on the pipes.
Do you find though, Brian, there's a bit of people get a little bit addicted then to the measures because they start off with something, you tease them with the grant for the lagging jacket or for the insulation. And then they think, oh, this is nice now. I'll look at the next thing. Is that what you want them to do?
Well, you kind of want to bring them along the road to get something done and try and, like, it will make a difference getting, say, if it was cavity walls or even just the attic does make a big difference. And you say, well, I noticed the difference of that. And then you start to see the value in having done it, that it's not just a concept that they haven't really thought
of. So slowly. And look, that's going to benefit a lot of people rather than thinking, gosh, I need thousands and thousands and thousands for a full retrofit of my house. You don't. You can just start off with the small stuff. Now, everyone listening might remember, or those of a certain age now, not you, Brian, right? Might remember the old Bord na Mona ad where the dog and the cat and the little mouse snuggled up together in front of the turf fire, burning brightly in this lovely, magnificent fireplace. And the fireplace is probably one of the most homely things we associate with our houses, whether it's a real or a fake fire or just, having a few candles on it or pictures or whatever. André, would you have us getting rid of the fireplace altogether?
I would, yeah. Well, look, everyone loves a real fire, but they're actually not very efficient at all. And chimneys do exactly the opposite to what we always thought they were doing. They're a big coal bridge and they're losing a lot of energy, especially when the fire's not on, they're actually sucking the heat out of your house. Similar to what a sunroom is doing at the back of the house when you've got a glass roof and the glass roof gets very hot in the summer and very cold at winter. And in actual fact, it's dragging the heat out of the house. So the fireplace, obviously, I mean, I love a fireplace, but the worst thing you can have is an open fireplace in a house because there you're losing the most amount of heat. So if you really want to have a fireplace, you should, as a minimum, have a stove where the fire is contained. So people often ask me, well, if I want an A-rated home, can I have my fireplace? And I say, well, yes, it's possible because a stove has an insulated flue and you can fish that through the existing chimney. But if the client really wants to keep it, well, we insulate the flue and the chimney as well.
Okay, so you might be gaining back some fans now after saying that. I've seen these kind of balloons that you could put up them when the fire isn't in use. Does that kind of thing help us? I'm really trying to keep the fire here, André. Help me out.
Well, the balloon is possible and I do have clients that have it, but you also have to remember that you have the balloon there. So if you ever want to... So it's a very quick fix. But ultimately, the whole breast going through the building and the chimney itself is a big heat sink.
Okay. So the but there are these great, beautiful fake fires that you can build into a wall, aren't there? I mean, they look absolutely gorgeous. They are hot and you can see the flames, but they're in this kind of glass, what would I say, like it's nearly like a picture on the wall.
Exactly. And that's creating the effect of a fireplace and conjuring up those images. And that works well as well. But yeah, so mostly if people want to keep a real fire, have a stove as a minimum.
Okay.
But in a lot of my jobs, we just remove the fireplace because, you know, once you got the entire building really warm at a constant temperature, you don't feel the need to go and put on a fire anymore.
Yeah, I think you're missing the point of the fire there, though. I'll be honest with you, Brian. Where do you stand on this? You're being very silent about the fire.
Yeah, it is a big, it's a very big cultural thing, and it's very hard to get people to take the fires out of their houses. But there's one thing I was talking about is like for every 4 bales of briquettes you'd put into a fire to eat it, you're only getting the heat from one of them. The heat from the other 3 is going straight up the chimney.
Wow, okay.
So they're really inefficient. Just as a means of heating, they're really inefficient.
And expensive 25%. Then.
Yeah. Like the solid fuel's getting more expensive. So I do get it, like as if you need to have, and look, I do get this indeed, the coziness thing. It's not necessarily with the heat. I've spoken to homeowners and said, and take one particular job, he tried to talk them out of getting the stove. He said, you don't need it. It's a really well-insulated house. Your heat pump will heat it perfectly. And he said, just one night to put it on, to watch a film, coziness factor. But then the temperature in the house went up, in the room went up to 28 degrees. So I had to throw open all the windows and the doors out into the back garden. So there was no value. But around Christmas time, people like that. So it's something that people keep for that time of year. It's more the
it's the Irish welcome, isn't it, really?
Exactly. Yeah. There is a real cultural attachment to it, but as a means of heating, they're really bad.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll leave that there and people can decide for themselves what line they want to go on there. But while we're on the subject of heat, there is a far better way and cozier way, I think, and possibly more expensive way of making our homes toasty, and that's underfloor heating. Now, this is a big project for anybody's home to kind of put it in. Andre, tell us what's involved in putting in underfloor heating.
Well, I've found that they work extremely well, and I have one in my own home and I'm delighted with it. So typically most houses have raised timber floors, and the way that works and the reason for them was in order to allow the timber to breathe. So you got the raised timber floor, which is typically 1 or 2 foot above the ground outside. And they have vents front and back. So they're bringing in these cold drafts underneath the floor and bringing them up through the house. So what we endeavor to do on most of our projects is to remove those raised timber floors, bring the floor back down to the original subfloor level, which was concrete. And then we put a minimum of 150mm rigid insulation on the floor. And that's when you put your underfloor heating on top of the insulation and put a screed over, liquid screed over. Now, the more insulation you can put in, the better. And, 20 years ago, underfloor heating had a bad reputation because they were fitted directly in the concrete slab. So it took hours and hours to heat them up. But once you insulate the floor below first and you've got them in a much thinner screed, well, then they're quick to perform and they can heat up the space much quicker.
Okay.
And it just keeps it at an even constant temperature across the entire room.
And you can walk around in your socks.
And it's great.
So are there homes then, and there must be maybe older homes, I'm thinking, that aren't suitable for that? And how do you find out?
You're right. And I find most houses that where it's not suitable is if they have an existing concrete floor, thick concrete floor, and the floor to ceiling, which you need to achieve for any room, is a minimum of 2.4 meters.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we've done them in many cases. So you actually have to go in and break the existing concrete floor, and that becomes very expensive.
Yeah.
And it's very time consuming as well. So,
but a good engineer, if you're getting them in, will be able to tell you that
and find out, at least
you can make that decision as well. Do I need to take up my lovely wooden floors if I'm going to get the underfloor heating put in, or can it be done with wooden floors?
It can be done with wooden floors, and I love those old wooden floors, and we have reused them. So you need to take up the wooden floors carefully and make sure that those old type of nails are removed carefully, and then you can put the underfloor heating in with the insulation, and in most cases the floor can be reused.
Okay.
But obviously you need to get good advice first, because some semi-solid and hardwood floors can be used, but some can't. But most cases you can reuse them.
Okay, good. So that's good to know, and that's a little bit of a saving there as well. Okay. And I understand that, you know, a lot of the time the underfloor heating works very well hand in hand with heat pumps, and we will be discussing the whole area of heat pumps on our next episode, and I'll be sure to bring up that issue again so that people can get the full picture of being able to use all that stuff. Because sometimes, Brian, it's cheaper to kind of think of it in the hole rather than do a bit here, and then it's a bit like digging the roads, have to dig it back up again to redo something else. And it can be infuriating maybe to think you've missed out on a bit that you could have got done just for the sake of a little bit extra thought.
And it's one of the things we do. Our new our BR certificate since 2021 includes an advisory report, which gives you an idea of, it tells you where you are now, but gives you an idea of where your, say, your roof is, your walls are, and how they compare with, say, are they very poor or fair. But it gives you an idea of what you need to improve. So you sort of have a roadmap there.
Oh, great.
And if you can discuss that with, say, a BR assessor, a contractor, or someone that can advise you on it, say, well, this is what you can do if you want to do it step by step, but how you can do it without blocking it from
doing
other things
down the line. It's like a menu.
Exactly.
The starter's the main course, and then the dessert at the end, which is the nice stuff to have. All right. Well, listen, I thank you so much. That's a huge amount of information that people can assimilate. Brian, where can they find out more about everything we've talked about?
It's saai.ie, and they're all in the grant section as well.
Oh, brilliant. All right. Well, look, that's it for today's episode, folks. And thank you to Brian and Andre for all those brilliant insights and tips for all of our listeners. Tune in next week. We'll have a mini episode where Brian and I will take 5 minutes to go through some of the most frequently asked questions that the SEAI receives on home energy upgrades. And if you enjoy this episode, there's plenty more to come on the 180 Degrees podcast. I'm Sinead Ryan, and we'll see you next time. If you've enjoyed this episode of the 180 Degrees podcast, well then why not review and subscribe to it now? And of course, share it with family and friends to find out more about renewables and energy. Well then, check out saai.ie.